In Hattiesburg, Wes stopped by the home of Judge Harrison for a quiet lunch. With 30 Bowmore cases on his docket, it would be unwise to be seen in public. Though they had no intention of discussing pending business, the coziness would seem inappropriate. Tom Harrison had extended the invitation to Wes and Mary Grace whenever they had the time. Mary Grace was out of town and sent her regrets. The subject was politics. Tom's circuit court district covered Hattiesburg and Forest County and the three rural counties of Cary, Lamar, and Perry. Almost 80% of the registered voters were in Hattiesburg, his home and also that of Joy Hoover, his opponent. She would do well in certain precincts in the city, but Judge Harrison was confident he would do even better. Nor was he worried about the smaller counties. In fact, he seemed generally unconcerned about losing. Hoover appeared to be well-financed, probably with outside money, but Judge Harrison knew his district and enjoyed its politics. Cary County had the smallest population of the four, and it was continuing to decline with no small measure of help from Crane Chemical and its toxic history. They avoided that topic and discussed various politicians in and around Bowmore. Wes assured him that the Paytons, as well as their clients, friends, Pastor Denny Ott, and Mary Grace's family, would do everything possible to re-elect Judge Harrison. Conversation shifted to other races, primarily that of Sheila McCarthy. She had passed through Hattiesburg 2 weeks earlier and spent half an hour at the Payton firm, where she awkwardly managed to avoid mentioning the Bowmore litigation while rounding up votes. The Paytons admitted they had no money to contribute, but promised to work overtime to get her reelected. A truckload of yard signs and other campaign materials had been delivered to the office the following day. Judge Harrison lamented the politicization of the Supreme Court. "It's unseemly," he was saying, "how they are forced to grovel for votes. You, as a lawyer representing a client in a pending case, should have no contact whatsoever with a Supreme Court justice. But because of the system, one comes to your office seeking money and support. Why? Because some special interests with plenty of money have decided they would like to own her seat on the court. They're spending money to purchase a seat. She responds by raising money from her side of the street. It's a rotten system, Wes. How do you fix it? Either take away the private money and finance the races with public funds, or switch to appointments. 11 other states have figured out how to make the appointment system work. I'm not sure their courts are vastly superior to ours in terms of legal talent, but at least the special interests don't control them." "Do you know Fisk?" Wes asked. "He's been in my courtroom a couple of times. Nice fella. Green as hell. Looks nice in a suit. Typical insurance defense routine. Opens his files, files his motions, settles, closes his files, never gets his hands dirty. He's never heard a case, mediated one, tried one, and he's never shown any interest in being a judge. Think about it, Wes. Every small town needs lawyers occasionally to serve as city judges or assistant magistrates or traffic court referees, and we all felt the obligation to step in when we were younger. Not this guy. Every small county needs lawyers to pinch hit with youth court and drug court and the like, and those of us who aspired to be real judges volunteered. I mean, you gotta start somewhere. Not this guy. I bet he's never been to city court in Brookhaven or youth court in Lincoln County. He wakes up one day, decides he's suddenly passionate about the judiciary, and what the hell, he'll just start at the top. It's an insult to those of us who toil in the system and make it work." I doubt if running was his idea. "No, he was recruited. That makes it even more shameful. They look around, pick some greenhorn with a nice smile and no record to attack, and package him with the slick marketing. That's politics, but it shouldn't contaminate the judiciary." "We beat him 2 years ago with McElwain. So you're optimistic?" "No, Judge. I'm terrified. I haven't slept well since Fisk announced, and I won't sleep well until he's defeated. We're broke and in debt, so we can't write a check, but every member of our firm has agreed to spend 1 hour a day knocking on doors, passing out brochures, putting up yard signs, and making phone calls. We've written letters to our clients. We're leaning on our friends. We've organized Bowmore. We're doing everything possible, because if we lose the Baker case, there is no tomorrow. Where is the appeal? All the briefs are in. Everything is nice and tidy and waiting on the court to tell us when and if it wants oral argument. Probably early next year. No chance of a decision before the election. None whatsoever. It's the most important case on the docket. But then every lawyer feels this way. As you know, the court works on its own schedule. No one can push it. They had iced coffee as they inspected the judge's small vegetable garden. The temperature was 100 degrees, and Wes was ready to go. They finally shook hands on the front porch. As Wes drove away, he couldn't help but worry about him. Judge Harrison was much more concerned about the McCarthy race than his own. The hearing was on a motion to dismiss filed by Hinds County. The courtroom belonged to Chancellor Phil Shingleton. It was a small, busy, efficient courtroom with oak walls and the obligatory faded portraits of long-forgotten judges. There was no box for the jurors because jury trials did not occur in Chancery Court. Crowds were rare, but for this hearing, every seat was taken. Meyercheck and Spano, back from Chicago, sat with their radical lawyer at one table. At the other were two young women representing the county. Chancellor Shingleton called things to order, welcomed the crowd, noted the interest from the media, and looked at the file. Two courtroom artists worked on Meyercheck and Spano. Everyone waited anxiously as Shingleton flipped through the paperwork as if he had never seen it. In fact, he had read it many times and had already written his ruling. "Just curious," he said without looking up, "why did you file this thing in Chancery Court?" The radical lawyer stood up and said, "It's a matter of equity, Your Honor, and we knew we could expect a fair trial here." If it was intended as humor, it missed its mark. The reason it was filed in Chancery Court was to get it dismissed as soon as possible. A hearing in circuit court would take even longer. A federal lawsuit would go off in the wrong direction. "Proceed," Shingleton said. The radical lawyer was soon railing against the county and the state and society in general. His words came in short, rapid bursts, much too loud for the small room and much too shrill to listen to for more than 10 minutes. He went on and on. The laws of the state were backward and unfair and discriminated against his clients because they couldn't marry each other. Why shouldn't two mature and consenting gay adults who are in love and want all the responsibilities and obligations and commitments and duties of matrimony be allowed the same privileges and legal rights as two heterosexuals? He managed to ask this question at least 8 different ways. "The reason," explained one of the young ladies for the county, "is that the laws of the state do not permit it. Plain and simple. The state's constitution grants to the legislature the right to make laws regarding marriage, divorce, and so on, and no one else has this authority. If and when the legislature approves same-sex marriage, then Mr. Meyercheck and Mr. Spano will be free to pursue their desires." "Do you expect the legislature to do this anytime soon?" Shingleton deadpanned. "No," was the quick reply, and it was good for some light laughter. The radical lawyer rebutted with the strenuous argument that the legislature, especially our legislature, passed laws every year that are struck down by the courts. That is the role of the judiciary. After making this point loud and clear, he devised several ways to present it in slightly different formats. After an hour, Shingleton was fed up. Without a recess and glancing at his notes, he gave a ruling that was rather succinct. His job was to follow the laws of the state, and if the laws of the state prohibited marriage between two men or two women or two men and one woman or whatever combination, anything other than one man and one woman, then he, as a chancellor, had no choice but to dismiss the case. Outside the courthouse, with Meyerchek on one side and Spano on the other, the radical lawyer continued his screeching for the press. He was aggrieved. His clients were aggrieved, though it was noted by a few that both looked quite bored with it all. They were appealing immediately to the Mississippi Supreme Court. That's where they were headed, and that's where they wanted to be. And with the shadowy firm of Troy Hogan paying the bills from Boca Raton, that's exactly where they were going. Chapter 23. During its first 4 months, the race between Sheila McCarthy and Ron Fisk had been markedly civil. Cleet Coley had thrown his share of mud, but his general appearance and unruly personality made it difficult for voters to see him as a Supreme Court justice. Though he still received about 10% in Reinhart's polls, he was campaigning less and less. Nat Lester's poll gave him 5%, but that poll was not as detailed as Reinhart's. After Labor Day, with the election 2 months away and the home stretch of the race at hand, Fisk's campaign took its first ugly step toward the gutter. Once on that course, it would not and could not turn back. The tactic was one Barry Reinhart had perfected in other races. A mass mailing was sent to all registered voters from an outfit called Lawsuit Victims for Truth. It screamed the question, why are the trial lawyers financing Sheila McCarthy? The four-page diatribe that followed did not attempt to answer the question. Instead, it excoriated trial lawyers. First, it used the family doctor, claiming that trial lawyers and the frivolous lawsuits they bring are responsible for many of the problems in our healthcare system. Doctors, laboring under the fear of lawsuit abuse, are forced to perform expensive tests and diagnoses that drive up the cost of medical care. Doctors must pay exorbitant premiums for malpractice insurance to protect themselves from bogus lawsuits. In some states, doctors have been driven out, leaving their patients without care. One doctor, no residence given, was quoted as saying, "I couldn't afford the premiums, and I was tired of spending hours in depositions and trials, so I simply quit. I still worry about my patients." A hospital in West Virginia was forced to close after getting hit with an outrageous verdict. A greedy trial lawyer was at fault. Next, it hit the checkbook. Rampant litigation cost the average household $1,800 a year, according to one study. This expense is a direct result of higher insurance premiums on automobiles and homes, plus higher prices for 1,000 household products whose makers are constantly being sued. Medications, both prescription and over-the-counter, are a perfect example. They would be 15% cheaper if the trial lawyers didn't hammer their manufacturers with massive class action cases. Then it shocked the reader with a collection of some of the country's zaniest verdicts, a well-used and trusted list that always sparked outrage. $3 million against a fast food chain for hot coffee that was spilled. $110 million against a car maker for a defective paint job. $15 million against the owner of a swimming pool that was fenced and padlocked. The infuriating list went on and on. The world is going crazy and being led by devious trial lawyers. After breathing fire for 3 pages, it finished with a bang. 5 years earlier, Mississippi had been labeled by a pro-business group as a judicial hellhole. Only 4 other states shared this distinction, and the entire process would have been overlooked but for the Commerce Council. It seized the news and splashed it around in newspaper ads. Now the issue was worthy of being used again. According to the Lawsuit Victims for Truth, the trial lawyers have so abused the court system in Mississippi that the state is now a dumping ground for all sorts of major lawsuits. Some of the plaintiffs live elsewhere. Many of the trial lawyers live elsewhere. They forum shop until they find a friendly county with a friendly judge, and there they file their cases. Huge verdicts are the result. The state has earned a shady reputation, and because of this, many businesses avoid Mississippi. Dozens of factories have packed up and left. Thousands of jobs are gone. All thanks to the trial lawyers, who of course adore Sheila McCarthy and her pro-plaintiff leanings and will spend anything to keep her on the court. The mailing ended with a plea for sanity. It never mentioned Ron Fisk. An email blast then sent the ad to 65,000 addresses in the district. Within hours, it had been picked up by the trial lawyers and sent to all of the MTA's 800 members. Nat Lester was thrilled with the ad. As campaign manager, he preferred broad-based support from many groups, but the reality was that the only major donors to McCarthy were the trial lawyers. He wanted them angry, spitting nails, frothing at the mouth, ready for an old-fashioned bare-knuckle brawl. So far, they had given just under $600,000. Nat needed twice that, and the only way to get it was by throwing grenades. He sent an email to every trial lawyer, and in it he explained the urgent necessity of answering the propaganda as quickly as possible. Negative ads, both in print and on television, must be responded to immediately. Direct mail is expensive, but very effective. He estimated the cost of the lawsuit victims for truth mailing at $300,000. Actual cost, $320,000. Since he planned to use direct mail more than once, he demanded an immediate infusion of $500,000, and he insisted on commitments by return email. His coded email address would publish a running total of new contributions from trial lawyers, and until it reached the goal of $500,000, the campaign would remain virtually hamstrung. His tactic bordered on extortion, but then he was still, at heart, a trial lawyer, and he knew the breed. The mailing jolted their blood pressure to near lethal levels. They loved to fight anyway, and the commitments would pour in. While he manipulated them, he met with Sheila and tried to calm her. She had never been attacked before in such a manner. She was upset, but also angry. The gloves were off, and Mr. Nathaniel Lester was relishing the fight. Within 2 hours, he had designed and written a response, met with the printer, and ordered the necessary supplies. 24 hours after the lawsuit victims for truth's plea was sent by email, 330 trial lawyers had committed $515,000. Nat also went after the Trial Lawyers of America, several of whose members had made fortunes in Mississippi. He emailed the lawsuit victims for truth's fulmination to 14,000 of its members. 3 days later, Sheila McCarthy counterpunched. Refusing to hide behind some silly group organized just to send propaganda, she, Nat, decided to send the correspondence from her own campaign. It was in the form of a letter, with a flattering photo of her at the top. She thanked each voter for his or her support and quickly ran through her experience and qualifications. She claimed to have nothing but respect for her opponents, but neither had ever worn the black robe. Neither, frankly, had ever shown any interest in the judiciary. Then she posed the question, why is big business financing Ron Fisk? Because, she explained in detail, big business is currently in the business of buying seats on Supreme Courts all over the country. They target justices like herself, compassionate jurists who strive for the common ground and are sympathetic to the rights of workers, consumers, victims injured by the negligence of others, the poor, and the accused. The law's greatest responsibility is to protect the weakest members of our society. Rich people can usually take care of themselves. Big business, through its myriad support groups and associations, is successfully coordinating a grand conspiracy to drastically change our court system. Why? To protect its own interests. How? By blocking the courthouse door. By limiting liability for companies that make defective products, for negligent doctors, for abusive nursing homes, for arrogant insurance companies. The sad list went on. She finished with a folksy paragraph asking the voters not to be fooled by slick marketing. The typical campaign run by big business in these races gets very ugly. Mud is their favorite tool. The attack ads would soon begin, and they would be relentless. Big business would spend millions to defeat her, but she had faith in the voters. Barry Reinhart was impressed with the response. He was also delighted to see the trial lawyers rally so quickly and spend so much money. He wanted them to burn money. The high end of his projection was $2 million for the McCarthy camp, with 90% from the trial lawyers. His boy Fisk could easily double that. His next ad, again by direct mail, was a sucker punch that would quickly dominate the rest of the campaign. He waited a week, time for the dust to settle from the first exchange of jabs. The letter came straight from Ron Fisk himself, on his campaign letterhead, with a photo at the top of the handsome Fisk family. Its ominous headline announced, "Mississippi Supreme Court to rule on gay marriage." After a warm greeting, Ron wasted no time in launching into the issue at hand. The case of Meyercheck and Spano versus Hinds County involved two gay men who wanted to get married, and it would be decided the following year by the Supreme Court. Ron Fisk, Christian, husband, father, lawyer, was adamantly opposed to same-sex marriages, and he would take this unshakable belief to the Supreme Court. He condemned such unions as abnormal, sinful, against the clear teachings of the Bible, and detrimental to society on many levels. Halfway through the letter, he introduced to the fray the well-known voice of the Reverend David Wilfong, a national loudmouth with a huge radio following. Wilfong decried such efforts to pervert our laws and bend yet again to the desires of an immoral few. He denounced liberal judges who insert their own beliefs into their rulings. He called upon the decent and God-fearing people of Mississippi, the heart and soul of the Bible Belt, to embrace men like Ron Fisk and, in doing so, protect their state's sacred laws. The liberal judge theme continued to the end of the letter. Fisk signed off with another promise to serve as a conservative, common-sense voice of the people. Sheila McCarthy read the letter with Nat, and neither knew what the next step should be. Her name was never mentioned, but then it really wasn't necessary. Fisk certainly wasn't accusing Cleet Coley of being a liberal. "This is deadly," Nat said, exasperated. "He has claimed this issue as his own, and to take it back, or even to share it, you have to pulverize homosexuals worse than he does." "I'm not doing that." "I know you're not." "It is so improper for a member of the court, or one who aspires to be, to state how he or she will decide a future case. It's horrible." "This is just the beginning, dear." They were in the cramped storage room that Nat called his office. The door was shut. No one was listening. A dozen volunteers were busy in the adjacent room. Phones rang constantly.
"I'm not sure we answer this," Nat said.
"Why not?"
"What are you going to say? Ron Fisk is being mean. Ron Fisk is saying things he shouldn't. You'll come off looking bitchy, which is okay for a male candidate, but not for a female.
That's not fair."
"The only response is a denial of your support for same-sex marriages. You would have to take a position which..."
"Which I'm not going to do. I'm not in favor of these marriages, but we need some type of civil union arrangement. It's a ridiculous debate, though, because the legislature is in charge of making laws, not the court."
Nat was on his fourth wife. Sheila was looking for husband number two.
"And besides," she said, "how could homosexuals possibly screw up the sanctity of marriage any worse than heterosexuals?"
"Promise me you'll never say that in public. Please."
"You know I won't."
He rubbed his hands together, then ran his fingers through his long gray hair. Indecisiveness was not one of his shortcomings.
We have to make a decision here and now, he said. We can't waste time. The smartest route is to answer by direct mail.
What's the cost?
We can scale back some. I'd say $200,000.
Can we afford it?
As of today, I would say no. Let's revisit it in 10 days.
Agreed. But can't we do an email blast and at least respond?
I've already written it.
The response was a 2-paragraph message sent that day to 48,000 email addresses. Justice McCarthy issued a strong rebuke to Ron Fisk for pledging his vote on a case he was far away from hearing. Had he been a member of the court, he would have been chastised. Dignity demands that the justices keep matters confidential and refrain from any comment whatsoever about pending cases. In the one he mentioned, no briefs have been filed in the appeal, no arguments heard, nothing was before the court as of this date. Without knowing the facts or the law, how could Mr. Fisk, or anyone else for that matter, possibly decide on a final ruling? Sadly, it was just another example of Mr. Fisk's woeful inexperience in judicial matters. Cleet Coley's losses were piling up at the Lucky Jack, and he confided this to Marlin late one night in a saloon in Under the Hill. Marlin was passing through, checking on the candidate, who seemed to have forgotten about the race.
I have a great idea, Marlin said, warming up to the real reason for his visit. There are 14 casinos on the Gulf Coast, big, beautiful Vegas style. I've seen them.
Right. I know the guy who owns Pirate's Cove. He'll put you up 3 nights a week for the next month. Penthouse suite, great view of the Gulf. Meals are on the house. You can play cards all night, and during the day, you can do a bit of campaigning. Folks down there need to hear your message. Hell, that's where the votes are. I can line up some audiences. You do the politicking. You've got a great speech, and people love it.
Cleet was visibly taken with the idea.
3 nights a week, huh?
More if you want it. You gotta be tired of this place.
Only when I'm losing.
Do it, Cleet. Look, the folks who put up the money would like to see more activity. They know it's a long shot, but they are serious about their message.
Cleet admitted it was a great idea. He ordered more rum and began thinking of those beautiful new casinos down there.
Chapter 24. Mary Grayson West stepped off the elevator on the 26th floor of the tallest building in Mississippi and into the plush reception suite of the state's largest law firm. She immediately noticed the wallpaper, the fine furniture, the flowers, things that had once mattered. The well-dressed woman at the desk was sufficiently polite. An associate in the standard-issue navy suit and black shoes escorted them to a conference room, where a secretary asked if they wanted something to drink. No, they did not. The large windows looked down at the rest of Jackson. The dome of the Capitol dominated the view. To its left was the Garten Building, and somewhere in there on someone's desk was the case of Jeanette Baker versus Crane Chemical. The door opened and Alan York appeared with a big smile and warm handshake. He was in his late 50s, short and heavy, and a bit sloppy. Wrinkled shirt, no jacket, scuffed shoes, unusual for a partner in such a hidebound firm. The same associate was back, carrying 2 large expandable files. After greetings and small talk, they took their places around the table. The lawsuit the Paytons filed in April on behalf of the family of the deceased pulpwood cutter had sped through the early rounds of discovery. No trial date was set, and that possibility was at least a year away. Liability was clear. The truck driver who caused the accident had been speeding at least 15 miles per hour over the limit. 2 eyewitnesses had been deposed and provided detailed and damning testimony about the speed and recklessness of the truck driver. In his deposition, the driver admitted to a long history of moving violations. Before taking to the road, he worked as a pipe fitter but had been fired for smoking pot on the job. Wes had found at least 2 old DUIs, and the driver thought there might be another one, but he couldn't remember. In short, The case wouldn't get anywhere near a jury. It would be settled, and after 4 months of vigorous discovery, Mr. Alan York was ready to begin the negotiations. According to him, his client, Lytton Casualty, was anxious to close the file. West began by describing the family, a 33-year-old widow and mother with a high school education and no real job skills, and three young children, the oldest being 12. Needless to say, the loss was ruinous in every way. As he talked, York took notes and kept glancing at Mary Grace. They had spoken on the phone but never met. Wes was handling the case, but York knew she was not there simply because she was pleasant to look at. One of his close friends was Frank Sully, the Hattiesburg lawyer hired by Crane Chemical to add bodies to the defense table. Sully had been pushed to the rear by Jared Curtin and was still bitter about it. He had passed along to York many stories about the Baker trial, and it was Sully's opinion that the Peyton tag team worked best when Mary Grace was chatting with the jury. She was tough on cross-examination, very quick on her feet, but her strength was connecting with people. Her closing argument was brilliant, powerful, and obviously very persuasive. York had been defending insurance companies for 31 years. He won more than he lost, but there had been a few of those awful moments when juries failed to see the case his way and nailed him for big verdicts. It was part of the business. He had never, though, been in the neighborhood of a $41 million award. It was now a legend in the state's legal circles. Add the drama of the Peytons risking everything, losing their home, office, cars, and borrowing heavily to sustain a four-month trial, and the legend kept growing. Their fate was well known and much discussed at bar meetings and golf tournaments and cocktail parties. If the verdict stood, they would be primed to rake in huge fees. A reversal, and their survival was seriously in doubt. As Wes went on, York couldn't help but admire them. After a brief review of the liability, Wes summed up the damages, added a chunk for the carelessness of the trucking company, and said, "We think $2 million is a fair settlement."
"I bet you do,"
York said, managing the customary defense lawyer reaction of shock and dismay, eyebrows arched in disbelief, head shaking slowly in bewilderment. He grabbed his face with his hand and squeezed his cheeks, frowning. His quick smile was long gone. Wes and Mary Grace managed to convey apathy while their hearts were frozen. "To get $2 million," York said, studying his notes, "you have to factor in some element of punitive damages, and frankly, my client is simply not willing to pay these." "Oh, yes," Mary Grace said coolly. "Your client will pay whatever the jury tells it to pay." Such blustering was also part of the business. York had heard it 1,000 times, but it did indeed sound more ominous coming from a woman who, during her last trial, extracted a huge punitive award. "A trial is at least 12 months away," York said as he looked at his associate for confirmation, as if anyone could project a trial date so far in the future. The associate dutifully confirmed what his boss had already said. "In other words, if this goes to trial, it will be months before you receive a dime in fees. It's no secret that your little firm is drowning in debt and struggling to survive, and everyone knows that you need a big settlement and quick."
"Your client can't wait that long," York said.
"We've given you a number, Alan," Wes replied. "Do you have a counteroffer?" York suddenly slapped his file shut and gave a forced grin and said,
"Look, this is really simple. Lytton Casualty is very good at cutting its losses, and this case is a loser. My authority to settle is $1 million, not a penny more. I have $1 million, and my client told me not to come back for more. $1 million, take it or leave it."
The referring lawyer would get half of the 30% contingency contract. The Peytons would get the other half. 15% was $150,000, a dream. They looked at each other, both frowning, both wanting to leap across the table and begin kissing Alan York. Then West shook his head and Mary Grace wrote something on a legal pad. "We have to call our client," West said. "Of course," York bolted from the room, his associate racing to keep up. "Well," West said softly, as if the room might be bugged. "I'm trying not to cry," she said. "Don't cry, don't laugh. Let's squeeze him a little." When York was back, West said gravely, "We talked to Mrs. Nolan. Her bottom line is $1.2 million. York exhaled as his shoulders drooped and his face sagged. "I don't have it, Wes," he said. "I'm being perfectly candid with you. You can always ask for more. If your client will pay $1 million, then he can kick in another $200,000. At trial, this case is worth twice that."
"Litton is a tough bunch, Wes."
"One phone call. Give it a try. What's there to lose?" York left again, and 10 minutes later burst back into the room with a happy face.
"You got it. Congratulations."
The shock of the settlement left them numb. Negotiations usually dragged on for weeks or months, with both sides bickering and posturing and playing little games. They had hoped to leave York's office with a general idea of where the settlement might be headed. Instead, they left in a daze and for 15 minutes roamed the streets of downtown Jackson, saying little. For a moment, they stopped in front of the Capitol Grill, a restaurant known more for its clientele than for its food. Lobbyists liked to be seen there, picking up tabs for fine meals with heavyweight politicians. Governors had always favored the place. Why not splurge and eat with the big boys? Instead, they ducked into a small deli 2 doors down and ordered iced tea. Neither had an appetite at the moment. Wes finally addressed the obvious. "Did we just earn $180,000? "Uh-huh," she said while sipping tea through a straw. "I thought so." "A third goes for taxes," she said. "Are you trying to kill the party?" "No, just being practical." On a white paper napkin, she wrote down the sum of $180,000. "Are we spending it already?" Wes asked. "No, we're dividing it. $60,000 for taxes? $50,000. Income, state and federal, employee withholding, Social Security, unemployment. I don't know what else, but it's at least a third." $55,000, he said, and she wrote down $60,000. "Bonuses?" "What about a new car?" he asked. "Nope. Bonuses for all 5 employees. They have not had a raise in 3 years. $5,000 each." She wrote down $25,000, then said, "The bank, a new car." "The bank? Half the fee is already gone. $200. Come on, Wes. We won't have a life until the bank is off our backs." "I've tried to forget about the loan." "How much?" "I don't know. I'm sure you have a figure." $50,000 for Huffy and $10,000 for Sheila McCarthy. That leaves us with $35,000, which at that moment seemed like a fortune. They stared at the napkin, both recasting the numbers and rearranging the priorities, but neither willing to suggest a change. Mary Grace signed her name at the bottom, then Wes did likewise. She put the napkin in her purse. "Can I at least get a new suit out of the deal?" he asked. "Depends on what's on sale. I guess we should call the office."
"They're sitting by the phone."
3 hours later, the Paytons walked into their office, and the party started. The front door was locked, the phones were unplugged, the champagne began to flow. Sherman and Rusty, the law clerks, proposed lengthy toasts they had hurriedly put together. Tabby and Vicky, the receptionists, were tipsy after 2 glasses. Even Olivia, the ancient bookkeeper, kicked up her heels and was soon laughing at everything. The money was spent, respent, overspent, until everyone was rich. When the champagne was gone, the office closed and everyone left. The Paytons, their cheeks warm from the bubbly, went to their apartment, changed into casual clothes, then drove to the school to fetch Mac and Liza. They had earned a night of fun, though the children were too young to understand the settlement. It would never be mentioned. Mac and Liza were expecting Ramona, and when they saw both parents in the school pickup line, A long day instantly became brighter. Wes explained that they simply got tired of working and decided to play. The first stop was Baskin-Robbins for ice cream. Next, they went to a shopping mall where a shoe store attracted their attention. Each Peyton picked out a pair at 50% off, with Mac being the boldest with a pair of marine combat boots. In the center of the mall was a four-screen cinema. They caught the 6 p.m. showing of the latest Harry Potter. Dinner was a family pizzeria with an indoor playground and a rowdy atmosphere. They finally made it home around 10, where Ramona was watching television and enjoying the quiet. The kids handed her leftover pizza and both talked at once about the movie. They promised to finish their homework in the morning. Mary Grace relented, and the entire family settled onto the sofa and watched a reality rescue show. Bedtime was pushed back to 11. When the apartment was quiet and the kids tucked in, Wes and Mary Grace lay on the sofa, heads on opposite ends, legs tangled together, minds drifting far away. For the past 4 years, as their finances had spiraled downward, with one loss after another, one humiliation following the last, fear had become a daily companion. Fear of losing the home, then the office, then the autos. Fear of not being able to provide for their children. Fear of a serious medical emergency that exceeded their insurance. Fear of losing the Baker trial. Fear of bankruptcy if the bank pushed too hard. Since the verdict, the fear had become more of a nuisance than a constant threat. It was always there, but they had slowly gained control of it. For 6 straight months now, they had paid the bank $2,000 a month, hard-earned monies that were left over after all the other bills and expenses. It barely covered the interest, and it reminded them of how insurmountable their debt was. But it was symbolic. They were digging out from the rubble and could see the light. Now, for the first time in years, there was a cushion, a safety net, something to catch them if they fell even deeper. They would take their share of today's settlement and hide it, and when they were afraid again, they would be comforted by their buried treasure. At 10 the following morning, Wes dropped by the bank and found Huffy at his desk. He swore him to silence, then whispered the good news. Huffy almost hugged him. Mr. Prickhead was on his back from 9 to 5, demanding action. "The money should be here in a couple of weeks," Wes said proudly. "I'll call as soon as it lands."
$50,000, Wes?" Huffy repeated, as if his job had just been saved.
"You got it." From there, Wes drove to his office. Tabby handed him a phone message from Alan York, just routine stuff, probably some details to nail down. But York's voice lacked its usual warmth.
"Wes, there's a new wrinkle," he said slowly, as if searching for words.
"What's the matter?"
Wes asked. A knot was already forming in his stomach. "I don't know, Wes. I'm really frustrated and confused. This has never happened to me. But, well, anyway, Litton Casualty has flipped on the settlement. It's off the table. All of it. They're yanking it. Some tough a-holes. I've been yelling at them all morning. They yell back. This firm has represented the company for 18 years. Never had a problem like this. But as of 1 hour ago, they are looking for another firm. I've fired the client. I gave you my word, and now my client has hung me out to dry. I'm sorry, Wes. Don't know what else to say."
Wes pinched the bridge of his nose and tried not to groan. After a false start, he said,
"Well, Alan, this is a shock." "Damned right it is, but in all fairness, it does no harm to the lawsuit. I'm just glad this didn't happen the day before the trial or something crazy like that. Some real bad boys up there."
"They won't be so tough at trial."
"Damned right, Wes. I hope you nail these guys for another huge verdict."
"We will."
"I'm sorry, Wes."
"It's not your fault, Alan.
We'll survive and push for a trial." "You do that."
"We'll talk later."
"Sure. Say, Wes, is your cell phone nearby?"
"It's right here."
"Here's my cell number. Hang up and call me back."
When both men were off the landlines, York said, "You didn't hear this from me, okay?"
"Okay."
"The chief in-house lawyer for Litton Casualty is a guy named Ed Larimore. For 20 years, he was a partner in a New York law firm called Bradley and Backstrom. His brother is also a partner at that firm. Bradley and Backstrom does the blue chip thing, and one of its clients is KDN, the oil exploration firm whose biggest shareholder is Carl Trudeau. That's the connection. I have never talked to Ed Larimore, there's no reason to, but the supervising attorney I deal with whispered to me that a decision was made at the very top to stiff this settlement."
"A little retribution, huh?"
"Smells like it. It's nothing illegal or unethical. The insurance company decides not to settle and goes to trial. Happens every day. There's nothing you can do about it, except burn them at trial. Litton Casualty has assets of $20 billion, so they aren't worried about a jury in Pike County, Mississippi. My guess is they'll drag it out until you get to trial, then try to settle."
"I'm not sure what to say, Alan.
I'm sorry this happened, Wes. I'm out of the picture now, and you didn't get this from me."
"Sure."
Wes stared at the wall for a long time, then mustered the energy to stand, walk, leave his office, and go look for his wife. Chapter 25. Like clockwork, Ron Fisk kissed Doreen goodbye at the front door at 6 o'clock on a Wednesday morning, then handed his overnight bag and briefcase to Monty. Guy was waiting in the SUV. Both assistants waved to Doreen, then they sped away. It was the last Wednesday in September, week 21 of his campaign, and the 21st consecutive Wednesday that he had kissed his wife goodbye at 6 a.m. Tony Zachary could not have found a more disciplined candidate. In the rear seat, Monty handed Ron his daily briefing. One of Tony's deputies in Jackson prepared it during the night and emailed it to Monty at exactly 5 each morning. Page 1 was the schedule. Page 2 was a summary of the 3 groups he would address that day, along with the names of the important people who would attend. Page 3 had updates from his opponents' campaigns. It was all mainly gossip, but still his favorite part of the briefing. Cleet Coley was last seen addressing a small group of sheriff's deputies in Hancock County, then retiring to the blackjack tables at Pirate's Cove. Today, McCarthy is expected to be at work and has no campaign events. Page 4 was the financial summary. Contributions so far totaled $1.7 million, with 75% coming from within the state. Expenditures of $1.8 million. The deficit was of no concern. Tony Zachary knew the heavy money would arrive in October. McCarthy had received $1.4 million, virtually all from trial lawyers. She had spent half of it. The prevailing thought in the Fisk camp was that the trial lawyers were tapped out. They were at the airport. The King Air lifted off at 6:30, and at that moment, Fisk was on the phone to Tony and Jackson. It was their first chat of the day. Everything was running smoothly. Fisk had already reached the point of believing that all campaigns were so effortless. He was always prompt, fresh, prepared, well-rested, well-financed, and ready to move on to the next event. He had little contact with the 24 people under Tony's thumb who sweated the details. Justice McCarthy's version of the daily briefing was a glass of fruit juice with Nat Lester at her Jackson headquarters. She aimed for 8:30 each morning and was fairly prompt. By then, Nat had put in 2 hours and was yelling at people. They had no interest in the whereabouts of her 2 opponents. They spent little time with poll numbers. Their data showed her running even with Fisk, and that was troubling enough. They quickly reviewed the latest fundraising schemes and talked about potential donors.
"I may have a new problem," she said that morning.
"Only one?"
"Do you remember the Frankie Hightower case?"
"Not at this moment, no."
"State trooper was gunned down in Grenada County 5 years ago. He stopped a car for speeding. Inside the car were 3 black men and a black teenager, Frankie Hightower. Someone opened fire with an assault weapon, and the trooper got hit 8 times, left him in the middle of Highway 51.
Let me guess. The court has reached a decision.
The court is getting close. 6 of my colleagues are ready to affirm the conviction.
Let me guess. You would like to dissent.
I'm going to dissent. The kid had inadequate counsel. His defense lawyer was some jackass with no experience and apparently very little intelligence. The trial was a joke. The other 3 thugs pled for life and pointed the finger at Hightower, who was 16 years old and sitting in the back seat without a gun. Yes, I'm going to dissent.
Nat's sandals hit the floor and he began to pace. Arguing the merits of the case was a waste of time. Arguing the politics of it would take some skill.
Coley will go ballistic.
I don't care about Coley. He's a clown.
Clowns get votes.
He's not a factor.
Fisk will receive it as a wonderful gift from God. More proof that his campaign is divinely inspired. Manna from heaven. I can see the ads now.
I'm dissenting, Nat. It's that simple.
It's never that simple. Some of the voters might understand what you're doing and admire your courage. Perhaps 3 or 4 of them. The rest will see the Fisk ad with the smiling face of that handsome young state trooper next to the mugshot of Frankie whatever his name is.
Hightower.
Thank you. The ad will refer to liberal judges at least 10 times, and it will probably show your face. Powerful stuff. You might as well quit now.
His words trailed off, but were bitter nonetheless. For a long time, they said nothing. Sheila broke the silence by saying,
"That's not a bad idea. Quitting. I've caught myself reading the briefs and asking, what will the voters think if I rule this way or that? I'm not a judge anymore, Nat. I'm a politician."
"You're a great judge, Sheila. One of the 3 we have left."
"It's all about politics now."
"You're not quitting. Have you written your dissent?"
"I'm working on it."
"Look, Sheila, the election is 5 weeks away. How slow can you write? Hell, the court is famous for taking its sweet time. Surely to God you can sit on this thing until after the election. What's 5 weeks? It's nothing. The murder was 5 years ago."
He was stomping around, arms flailing.
"We do have a schedule."
"Bullshit. You can manipulate it."
"For politics?"
"Damned right, Sheila. Give me a break here. We're busting our asses for you, and you act like you're too good for the dirty work. This is a filthy business, okay?"
"Lower your voice."
He lowered it several octaves, but kept pacing. 3 steps to one wall, then 3 steps to the other.
"Your dissent is not going to change a damned thing. The court will run over you again 6-3, maybe even 7-2, perhaps even 8-1. The numbers don't really matter. The conviction is affirmed, and Frankie whoever will stay exactly where he is right now and where he'll be 10 years from now. Don't be stupid, Sheila."
She finished her fruit juice and did not respond.
"I don't like that smirk," Nat said.
He pointed a long, bony finger at her.
"Listen to me. If you file a dissent before the election, I'm walking out the door."
"Don't threaten me."
"I'm not threatening. I'm promising. You know 10 different ways to sit on that case for another 5 weeks. Hell, you could bury it for 6 months.
She stood and said, "I'm going to work."
"I'm not kidding," he yelled. "I'll quit."
She yanked the door open and said,
"Go find us some money."
3 days later, the skillfully coordinated avalanche began. Only a handful of people knew what was coming. Ron Fisk himself did not comprehend the scope of his own saturation. He had performed for the cameras, changed into various outfits, worked his way through the scripts, dragged in his family and some friends, and he was aware of the budget and the media buys and the market shares of the various television stations in South Mississippi. And in a normal campaign, he would have worried about financing such expensive marketing. But the machine that bore his name had many parts he knew nothing about. The first ads were the soft ones, warm little vignettes to open the doors and let this fine young man into the homes. Ron, as a Boy Scout, with the richly accented old voice of an actor playing the role of his scoutmaster in the background.
One of the finest Boy Scouts we ever had. He made it to Eagle in less than 3 years.
Ron in a robe at high school graduation, a star student. Ron with Doreen and the kids, and his own voice saying, "Families are our greatest asset." After 30 seconds, the ad signed off with the slogan, in a deep, heavenly voice, "Ron Fisk, a judge with our values." A second ad, a series of black and white still photos, began with Ron on the steps of his church in a fine dark suit chatting with his pastor, who narrated, "Ron Fisk was ordained as a deacon in this church 12 years ago. Ron with his jacket off teaching Sunday school. Ron holding his Bible as he makes a point to a group of teenagers under a shade tree. Thank God for men like Ron Fisk." Ron and Doreen greeting people at the church's door, and the same farewell. "Ron Fisk, a judge with our values." There was not the slightest hint of conflict. Nothing about the campaign, not a trace of mud. No indication of the savagery that would follow. Just a charming hello from an incredibly wholesome young deacon. The ads blanketed South Mississippi and Central as well, because Tony Zachary was paying the steep prices charged by the Jackson outlets. September 30th was a crucial date on Barry Reinhart's calendar. All contributions made in the month of October would not be reported until November 10th, 6 days after the election. The flood of out-of-state money he was about to unleash would go undetected until it was too late. The losers would scream, but that was all they could do. On September 30th, Reinhart and company kicked into high gear. They began with their A-list: tort reform groups, right-wing religious organizations, business lobbyists, business PACs, and hundreds of conservative organizations ranging from the well-known American Rifle Association to the obscure Zero Future Tax, a small gang dedicated to abolishing the Internal Revenue Service. 1,140 groups in all 50 states. Reinhart sent each a detailed memo and request for an immediate donation to the Fisk campaign in the amount of $2,500, the maximum for an organized entity. From this collection, his goal was $500,000. For the individual's $5,000 maximum gift, Reinhart had a list of 1,000 corporate executives and senior managers of companies in industries that attracted litigation from trial lawyers. Chief among these were insurance companies, and he would collect $1 million from his contacts there. Carl Trudeau had given him the names of 200 executives of companies controlled by the Trudeau Group, though no one from Crane Chemical would write a check. If the Fisk campaign took money from Crane, then a front-page story was likely. Fisk might feel compelled to recuse himself, a disaster Reinhart couldn't begin to contemplate. He expected $1 million from Carl's boys, though it would not go directly into the Fisk campaign. To keep their names away from nosy reporters and to make sure no one ever knew of Mr. Trudeau's involvement, Reinhart routed their money into the bank accounts for Lawsuit Victims for Truth and Gun Owners United Now, GUN. His B list contained 1,000 names of donors with proven records of supporting pro-business candidates, though not at the $5,000 level. He expected another $500,000. $3 million was his goal, and he was not at all concerned about reaching it. Chapter 26. In the excitement of the moment, Huffy had made a dreadful mistake. The expectation of a meaningful payment, coupled with the constant pressure from Mr. Prickhead, had caused a lapse in judgment. Not long after Wes stopped by with the promise of $50,000, Huffy marched into the big office and proudly informed his boss that the Paytons' debt was about to be reduced. When he got the bad news 2 days later that it was not, He was too afraid to tell anyone. After losing sleep for almost a week, he finally forced himself to confront the devil again. He stepped in front of the massive desk, swallowed hard, and said,
"Some bad news, sir."
"Where's the money?" Mr. Kirkhead demanded.
"It's not going to happen, sir. Their settlement fell through."
Forgoing curse words, Mr. Prickhead said,
"We're calling the loan. Do it now."
"What?"
"You heard me."
"We can't do that. They've been paying $2,000 a month."
"Super. That doesn't even cover the interest. Call the loan now."
"But why?"
"Just a couple of small reasons, Huffy. Number one, it's been in default for at least a year. Number two, it's grossly under-collateralized. As a banker, certainly you can understand these small problems."
"But they're trying."
"Call the loan. Do it now, and if you don't, then you'll be either reassigned or dismissed."
"That's obscene."
"I don't care what you think."
Then he relented a bit and said,
"It's not my decision, Huffy. We have new ownership, and I have been ordered to call the loan."
"But why?"
Kirkhead picked up the phone and offered it.
"You want to call a man in Dallas?
This will bankrupt them."
"They've been bankrupt for a long time. Now they can make it official."
"Son of a bitch."
"Talking to me, son?"
Huffy glared at the fat, hairless head, then said,
"Not really. More to that son of a bitch in Dallas."
"We'll keep that here, okay?"
Huffy returned to his office, slammed the door, and watched the walls while an hour passed. Prickhead would stop by soon for the follow-up. Wes was in a deposition downtown. Mary Grace was at her desk and took the call. She admired Huffy for his bravery in extending much more credit than anyone had thought possible, but the sound of his voice always rattled her.
"Good morning, Tom," she said pleasantly.
"It's not a good morning, Mary Grace," he began. "It's a bad morning, an awful morning, one of the worst ever."
A heavy pause.
"I'm listening."
"The bank. Not the bank you've been dealing with, but another bank now. One owned by some people I've met only once and never care to see again. Has decided that it can no longer wait to be paid. The bank, not me, is calling the loan."
Mary Grace emitted a strange guttural sound that could have passed for an expletive, but really wasn't a word at all. Her first thought was of her father. Other than the Peyton signatures, the only security for the loan was a 200-acre tract of farmland her father had owned for many years. It was near Bowmore, and it did not include the 40 acres and family home. The bank would foreclose on the property.
"Any particular reason, Huffy?"
she asked coolly.
"None whatsoever. The decision was not made in Hattiesburg. Second State sold out to the devil, if you will recall."
"This doesn't make sense."
"I agree.
You'll force us into bankruptcy, and the bank will get nothing,
except for the farm."
"So you'll foreclose on the farm?"
"Someone will. I hope not me."
"Smart move, Huffy, because when they foreclose on the courthouse steps in Bowmore, there might be a killing.
Maybe they'll get old Prickhead."
"Are you in your office?"
"Yes, with the door locked."
"Wes is downtown. He'll be there in 15 minutes. Unlock the door."
"No."
15 minutes later, Wes charged into Huffy's office, his cheeks red with anger, his hands ready to strangle.
"Where's Prickhead?" he demanded.
Huffy jumped to his feet behind his desk and placed both hands in the air.
"Be cool, Wes."
"Where's Prickhead?"
"Right now he's in his car, driving to an urgent meeting, one that suddenly materialized 10 minutes ago." "Sit down, Wes."
Wes took a deep breath, then slowly eased into a chair. Huffy watched him, then returned to his own chair.
"It's not his fault, Wes," Huffy said. "Technically, the loan has been in default for almost 2 years. He could have done this months ago, but he didn't. I know you don't like him. I don't like him. His wife doesn't like him. But he's been very patient. This was a decision made in the home office."
"Give me a name at the home office."
Huffy slid across a letter he had received by fax. It was addressed to the Paytons on New Vista Bank letterhead and signed by a Mr. F. Patterson Duval, vice president.
This arrived 30 minutes ago, Huffy said. I don't know Mr. Duval. I've called his office twice, but he's in a very important meeting, one that I'm sure will last until we stop calling. It's a waste of time, Wes.
The letter demanded payment in full of $414,656.22, with daily interest kicking in at $83.50. Pursuant to the terms of the loan agreement, the Paytons had 48 hours to pay, or collection and foreclosure proceedings would commence. Of course, the resulting attorney's fees and court costs would also be tacked onto the amount due. Wes read it slowly as he continued to cool down. He placed it back on the desk.
Mary Grace and I talk about this loan every day, Huffy. It's part of our marriage. We talk about the kids, the office, the debt to the bank, what's for dinner. It's always there, and we've busted our asses to pay off all other obligations so we can bust our asses to pay off the bank. We came very close to giving you $50,000 last week. We vowed to work ourselves ragged until this bank is out of our lives. Now this stunt. Now some moron in Dallas has decided he's tired of seeing this past due loan on his daily rap sheet, and he wants to get rid of it. You know what, Huffy?
What?
The bank just screwed itself. We'll file for bankruptcy, and when you try to foreclose on my father-in-law's property, I'll put him in bankruptcy. And when we work our way out of bankruptcy and we're back on our feet, guess who ain't getting paid?
The moron in Dallas?
You got it. The bank gets nothing. It'll be wonderful. We can keep the $400,000 when we earn it.
Late that afternoon, Wes and Mary Grace called a firm meeting in the pit. Other than the humiliation of filing for bankruptcy, which seemed to bother no one, there was little to worry about. In fact, the bank's actions would give the firm some breathing room. The $2,000 monthly payments would cease, and the cash could certainly be used elsewhere. The concern, of course, was the land owned by Mr. Shelby, Mary Grace's father. Wes had a plan. He would find a friendly buyer who would appear at the foreclosure and write a check. Title would pass, and it would be held in a handshake trust until the Paytons could buy it back, hopefully within a year. Neither Wes nor Mary Grace could stomach the idea of asking her father to join them at the bankruptcy court. 48 hours passed with no payment. Sticking to its word, the bank filed suit. Its lawyer, a local gentleman the Paytons knew well, called ahead of time and apologized. He had represented the bank for years and could not afford to lose it as a client. Mary Grace accepted his apology and gave him her blessing to sue them. The next day, the Paytons filed for bankruptcy, both individually and as Payton & Payton, attorneys at law. They listed combined assets of $35,000, two old cars, furniture, office equipment, all of which was protected. They listed debts of $420,000. The filing effectively stayed the lawsuit and would eventually render it useless. The Hattiesburg American reported it on its second page the following day. Carl Trudeau read about it online and laughed out loud. "Sue me again," he said with great satisfaction. Within a week, three Hattiesburg law firms informed Old Prickhead that they were withdrawing their funds, closing their accounts, and moving their business down the street. There were at least eight other banks in town. A wealthy trial lawyer named Jim McMay called Wes and offered assistance. The two had been friends for many years and had collaborated twice on product liability cases. McMay represented four Bowmore families in the Crane litigation, but had not pushed the cases aggressively. Like the other trial lawyers suing Crane, he was waiting for the outcome of Baker and hoping to hit the jackpot if and when there was a settlement. They met for breakfast at Nanny's, and over biscuits and country ham, McMay readily agreed to rescue the 200 acres at foreclosure and keep the title until the Paytons could buy it back. Farmland in Cancer County wasn't exactly selling at a premium, and Wes speculated that the Shelby property would fetch around $100,000, the only money the bank would collect from its foolish maneuver. Chapter 27. Sheila McCarthy was enduring the morning's torture on the treadmill when she hit the stop button and gawked at the television in disbelief. The ad ran at 7:29, smack in the middle of the local news. It began with the provocative sight of two well-dressed young men kissing passionately while a minister of some variety smiled behind them. A husky voiceover announced, "Same-sex marriages are sweeping the country. In places like Massachusetts, New York, and California, laws are being challenged. Advocates of gay and lesbian marriages are pushing hard to force their lifestyles on the rest of our society." A still photo of a wedding couple, male and female, at the altar was suddenly desecrated with a bold black X. "Liberal judges are sympathetic to the rights of same-sex marriages." The photo was replaced with a video of a group of happy lesbians waiting to tie the knot in a mass ceremony. "Our families are under attack from homosexual activists and liberal judges who support them." Next was a quick video of a mob burning an American flag. The voice said, "Liberal judges have approved the burning of our flag." Then a quick shot of a magazine rack lined with copies of Hustler. "Liberal judges see nothing wrong with pornography." Then a photo of a smiling family, mother and father and four children. "Will liberal judges destroy our families?" the narrator inquired ominously, leaving little doubt that they would if given half a chance. The family photo was ripped apart into two jagged pieces. Suddenly, the handsome but serious face of Ron Fisk appeared. He looked sincerely at the camera and said, "Not in Mississippi. One man, one woman. I'm Ron Fisk, candidate for the Supreme Court, and I approved this ad." Dripping with sweat, her heart pounding even faster, Sheila sat on the floor and tried to think. The weatherman was prattling on, but she didn't hear him. She lay down on her back, stretched out her arms and legs, and took deep breaths. Gay marriage was a dead issue in Mississippi and would remain so forever. No one with an audience or a following had dared to suggest that the laws be changed to allow it. Every member of the state legislature could be expected to rail against it. Only one judge in the entire state, Phil Shingleton, had addressed it, and he had dismissed the Meyercheck-Spano lawsuit in record speed. The Supreme Court would probably deal with that case in a year or so, but Sheila expected a rather terse review followed by a quick 9-0 vote affirming Judge Shingleton. How exactly had she now been cast as a liberal judge who supported gay marriage?